this week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
We know that the electoral system under capitalism is a sham, and the constituents of Democrats and Republicans are the bankers and the corporations and the war makers. We understand that the moment is a historical moment in which we can make an intervention to bring about another option.
Claudia De La Cruz, presidential candidate for the Party for Socialism and Liberation, on the debacle that the two-party system faces in this year's presidential election.
These people just need some help. The reason I'm here is to help them scream from the mountaintop. I hope this catches fire and people understand how critical this is to the well-being of our fellow Americans. This is tragic.
Over a year after the Norfolk Southern train derailed in East Palestine, Ohio, residents are struggling to access critical health care. A coalition of activists from across the country is urging the Biden administration to take action.
What the wars were about with the American Indian tribes, what those wars were really about, were about land and land retention.
For Women's History Month, we honor Wilma Mankiller, who in 1983 became the principal chief of the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma and the first woman to serve as a chief of an indigenous nation in the United States. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Akua Holt. Veteran Bloc Report host and journalist J.R. Valray spoke to third-party presidential candidate Claudia De La Cruz of the Party for Socialism and Liberation about this election year.
Today, our guest is Claudia De La Cruz, the presidential candidate for the Party for Socialism and Liberation. She is also a liberation theologist, organizer, as well as mother and many other things. How are you, Claudia?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me. Good to speak with you, JR.
It's good to speak with you. I've been aware of your work for many years. And so it's good to see that you have a platform to go around the country. Can you tell the people what brought you into running for president and why did you decide to run with the party you're running with?
Well, I think it's important to say that I didn't plan to be the presidential candidate in any party. I think our people's relationship to electoral politics has never really been the greatest one. It's been one that's been marked by betrayal. And I am part of the working class. I'm also a second generation immigrant to Dominican parents who have experienced what it means to migrate due to U.S. imperialism and what capitalism has done to many of our countries in the global South. And so for me, it was not a plan to become the presidential candidate of the United States. I'm part of the Party for Socialism and Liberation, which is a Marxist-Leninist party that has a tradition that goes beyond the 20 years of its existence in this country. It has many comrades who have been involved in many struggles, the anti-war movement, Black liberation movement, indigenous and Native American liberation movements as well. And it was at the request of these comrades who are part of our party, who are also working class people, that I became the candidate. Myself and Karina Garcia, who's now the VP candidate for the party. And we thought it was important to uphold the socialist tradition of intervening in the elections as a way of uplifting and raising the contradictions of the electoral system and the bourgeois democracy in which we live. We thought it was important to raise the demands and the solutions that are there that actually reflect the people's needs and that meet the scale of the crisis that we're in, which is something that the Democrats or the Republicans never do, because we know that the electoral system under capitalism is a sham. And the constituents of Democrats and Republicans are the bankers and the corporations and the war makers. We understand that the moment is a historical moment in which we can make an intervention to bring about another option an option that is a people's option. That's why we are running explicitly as socialists.
Right.
And as socialists, you know, we don't believe, again, that elections between two parties that are representing the wealthy will determine our liberation as working class people. Elections is not a time for revolutionaries and progressives to be silent. Like, it's a time for us to intervene and be bold and be loud about our politics. It is a great opportunity to intervene with a clear message.
Right.
And shed light on just how perverse and how hypocritical the nature of this dollar democracy and capitalism is.
Let's start out some of the platform that you and your colleague is running on. We are basically engaged in World War III, and we know about the countries that are being annihilated, places like Palestine. You have the war with Russia and Ukraine, but you also have some of the other wars that are not being talked about as much, such as what's going on in Haiti, what's going on in the Congo, Sudan, Somalia, but also what's going on in Cuba. Can you talk a little bit about some of the international platform, and for the people that are not as politically educated on the lingo, what is imperialism and what is the United States' stance and what is your platform stance on imperialism in whatever country you decide to deal with?
It's important to say, sometimes people hear the word empire or imperialism, U.S. imperialism specifically, and they think it's something outside of the U.S. And I want to just emphasize how connected the lives of working class people in the United States are with people across the globe, especially, again, our siblings who are working class people, the most dispossessed and most historically marginalized. Our lives are connected, and whatever happens externally impacts the domestic life of the United States and vice versa. And I'll share this small fact. In the United States, we have 800 people who die from poverty-related issues every day. Not every year. 800 people die of poverty-related issues every day in the wealthiest country in the world. That be people's inability to access food, people's inability to access healthcare, people's inability to secure housing, not because they're deficient, because it's not that our people are deficient, it's the system that's deficient, it's a system that's criminal. It does not create the conditions for our people to be able to live dignified lives. In that same way, this capitalist system in which we live, the economic and political system in which we live, murders people in Gaza by starvation, murders people in Gaza through war, murders people in Haiti by creating destabilization politically, economically, socially, doing the same thing in Congo and Sudan and all across the globe, sanctioning countries like Venezuela, which ultimately strangle their economy so it produces a high number of working class people to be forced to migrate. The same thing in Cuba. And so we're talking about U.S. imperialism in the United States, in Haiti, in Cuba, in Sudan, its impacts in these places, including the United States. Because when we talk about U.S. imperialism, we're talking about the highest stage of global capitalism, which is the economic system that dominates society and that exploits and oppresses working class people all across the globe. And so the reason that I want to be able to define U.S. imperialism in that way is because, again, it doesn't only impact people outside of this country. It impacts people inside of this country because it's the same system. With Gaza, Gaza has unveiled a lot of the hypocrisy of this country. When we are talking about democracy, and yet we impose on the Palestinian people a colonial state, which is Israel. And not only do we impose that colonial state since 1948, we finance it. Like, it comes out of our tax dollars to finance them. And they have health care on the backs of U.S. people who don't have health care themselves. And so when we're talking about U.S. imperialism, we're talking about something that affects working class people here, because it's at the expense of working class people here and at the expense of working class people all across the globe that U.S. imperialism can sustain itself.
Well, why was trying to put it out there first, show U.S. imperialism, because a lot of times we cannot see things when it is so close upon us. We need to see something somewhere else. And then when we see our connection to it, then we understand the web that we're all connected and that everywhere plays a part. So when you talk about what's going on in the United States, the media calls it a recession. I know that you're based in the New York area, but that you also have had the opportunity to travel all over the country. Do you see black and brown people, especially, do you see working class people at a recession, or do you see us at a depression?
I mean, people are struggling to survive. People are struggling to make ends meet. And I think it's something that across the spectrum, black and brown communities are unfortunately disproportionately impacted by any economic crisis because of all the historical factors that come with our conditions. What I see is that you have the Democrats, the Republicans, and the ruling class saying, well, the economy is doing great. I hate those reports, JR. Like, the economy is booming. It's doing great. We're, you know, and they start giving you all these percentages. And that economy that they're speaking about is the economy of ruling class people who have been able to not duplicate their wealth, but quadruple their wealth in a moment of inflation and recession for our people. Our people are in a position where they cannot afford healthcare across the board. People cannot afford healthcare. And if they don't have jobs, which is the reality in the majority of our communities, there are high levels of unemployment, they can't have access to health insurance because their jobs give them health, if they're lucky enough, right? We also have a whole group of our folks that are engaged in the gig economy, which means that they have more than one stable job. They have several jobs that they have to be able to hold, to be able to make ends meet, if at all. I was in South Carolina just this past weekend. There is no minimum wage. They follow the minimum wage, which is a federal minimum wage of $7.25. And 42% of adults in South Carolina have a wage of $15 an hour. That is crazy. That is crazy, yeah. In a society where prices are
crazy, like, inflated.
Prices are increasing everywhere. You would have probably purchased a pack of eggs 2 years ago and it would have been $3, and now it's close to $8. Right. So you have people that are earning $15 an hour. These are adults with children, heads of households, and that's 42% of the population in South Carolina does not have livable wages. They would have to work 106 hours a week to be able to hold a two-bedroom apartment. That is criminal.
Right.
That is a condition in which our people are living. People are dying because they can't access medication for their diabetes. We have high numbers of our people that are dying because their limbs need to be cut, because there's no preventive medication for that in the wealthiest country in the world. They have no access to that. And so our people are experiencing one of the biggest crises that we have experienced as a society in many decades, in many decades. When we talk about women's rights, reproductive rights have been rolled back. When we're talking about people's access to critical race theory and the possibility of learning our history, that has been rolled back. There's books that are being banned. There are specific attacks to working class people. Amazon workers are still trying to get Jeff Bezos to come to the negotiation table, and he is unwilling, and they are unwilling to do it all across the board because they gain more from exploiting workers than negotiating any type of rights for workers. And so we're in a dire, like, very deep crisis as a working class people, as black and brown people. And we are being completely neglected by the system. We are completely being neglected by the capitalist state. And the Democrats and the Republicans only play, you know, political ping pong with our needs. They dangle the possibility of them actually giving us crumbs. And they take that away whenever the election period comes out of the question. They don't have conversations with us about food and debt. They don't have conversations with us about housing. I mean, it's amazing that these people are able to call a session in Congress and they can, in a bipartisan way, pass a resolution criminalizing people that are standing against genocide, but they cannot come to a session and make a solution for the housing crisis, where you have over 500,000 people who are living in the streets in the United States, in the wealthiest country in the world. The way in which the political class and the ruling class are organizing or reorganizing themselves is precisely to defend capitalism as a stance, to defend U.S. imperialism as a stance. And to them, it doesn't matter who rules. It doesn't matter whether it is the Democrats or the Republicans. It doesn't matter whether it is through consent or through force, because that's what it means. It means that, you know, the forceful ones are the Republicans, quote unquote. And the Democrats are the ones that kind of generate a certain level of national consent to be oppressed. We have seen for the last 6 months, millions of people take the streets all across the country to say, we need a ceasefire. We need to end the occupation. And what has the political class of this country done? Completely disregard any demands from its people. The Democrats are becoming weaker and weaker. They're becoming weaker and weaker. They're like 67% of their own people, their own base, are against this genocide of Israel in Palestinian land. They are against the mass slaughter of Palestinian people by the Israeli. 67% between the ages of 18 and 34. And this political class in the Democratic Party is saying, we don't care about y'all. Actually, your opinion doesn't matter. We need to uphold U.S. imperialism. Right. And they're setting up the stage for the next person to come to the White House, the next tenant of the White House, to occupy it and continue to uphold U.S. imperialism.
Right.
They really don't care who it is. And so we need to, as working class people, come to the understanding that we need to stop legitimizing the ruling class politics in this country, that we need to stop buying into their narratives. There's no lesser of two evils in this country. There are evil. And so we need to do for ourselves what we need to do for ourselves. And that is not going to be determined in one election year. That's going to be determined by our capacity to organize every day.
You were listening to the voice of Claudia De La Cruz, the presidential candidate of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. She is a liberation theologist, longtime educator, mother, organizer, and many other things. Can you tell the people how they can get more information about your campaign?
If folks want more information about the campaign, they could log on to VoteSocialist2024.com. VoteSocialist2024.com. Folks could register to volunteer and they could get more information on what we're trying to do on there.
I appreciate you coming on with us on the Black Report.
Thank you for having me, JR.
This is the Minister of Information, JR, signing off. If you would like to get more information on the Black Report, go to Instagram at Black Report Official.
Thanks to Black Report host and journalist J.R. Valray for filing this report.
Power to the people! Power to the people! Power to the people! Power to the people!
That was Power to the People by John Lennon and Plastic Ono Band. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Akua Holt. Over 1 year ago in East Palestine, Ohio, a Norfolk Southern train derailed and the company ignited thousands of pounds of toxic vinyl chloride. Now, East Palestine residents and families are getting sick and remaining in their contaminated town because they can't afford to move out. They're also losing their health care. On Saturday, March 23rd, there was a community meeting in East Palestine to launch a national campaign calling for justice for residents and workers who responded to the disaster. The campaign's main demand is that the federal government provide full health care to all residents of East Palestine and surrounding areas, and to any fire or emergency workers sickened by direct exposure to the toxic fumes and burn. At the conference, Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer spoke with Pittsburgh Union Progress reporter Steve Mellon and Teamster Vice President John Palmer.
This is Steve Zeltzer. We're in East Palestine, and we're at a meeting to discuss the defense of the people and workers of East Palestine more than a year after a railroad wreck by Norfolk Southern. And we have two labor people, two working people, who are going to be talking about why they're here at the conference.
I'm Steve Mellon. I'm a striking worker at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette newspaper.
I'm John Palmer. I'm a longtime Teamster and International Vice President.
Steve, you've been covering this struggle here in East Palestine. This is the first, like, national meeting here in East Palestine. What has been going on, and why has there been so little coverage, really, of the issues for the workers and people of East Palestine who are losing their health care and still fighting to survive?
Well, I think, you know, there was a lot of coverage here right after the derailment, and that's kind of, I've seen that happen over and over and over again. You know, there's this moment of crisis in a community, and all the big networks come into town, CNN, Fox News, all those folks, they come into town, and they cover that moment, and then they move on, because there's always another crisis. There's a mass shooting someplace, or there's another derailment, or there's a big political story, and so the national attention moves on, and like life moves on. Like the East Palestine looks normal because the truth is Norfolk Southern had that train running within a couple of days after that big burn off. I mean, we all saw on national TV that big mushroom cloud 3 days after the derailment when they burned off 2 million gallons of vinyl chloride and sent that massive toxic cloud over the city. And so like you went there a week later, 2 weeks later, and the trains are running through again. And it looks like everything's normal. Well, of course, for the people, it's not normal, because they still have to go to bed every night wondering whether the toxins that hovered over their town during that toxic burn-off were still in their pillows, were still in the water that they drank, the food that they were, when their kids went out to play in the yard. Am I poisoning my kid? They still had to live with that. But of course, the media and the national attention, you know, we all moved on. They could not move on. They had to continue to struggle through this. You know, we've been on strike for now 17 months, and you know, we were kind of free of the necessity of feeding the beast, a newspaper beast. Like, if I went out on an assignment, I had to come back with a story because the newspaper needed stories. We have a strike paper now, but we're the bosses. Like, working people are the bosses. We can publish stories the way we think they need to be published. We can report them the way they need to be reported. That has allowed us as journalists, the handful of us that are working on the strike paper, to come up here, spend time with people, develop the relationships with these people in East Palestine who are going through this. So they don't look at me and say, this is a guy that's just going to come in and take my story and go and do what he wants with it. They know I'm going to be back next week and the week after next and the week after next. And if I screw the story up, they're going to tell me about it. If I miss something or get something wrong, they're going to tell me about it.
And having real journalism to get these stories, it's a battle.
Oh,
it's a battle, as you say. I mean, one of the issues is the destruction of newspaper jobs by these all this global capital closing newspapers around the country, laying off journalists, and you wonder why you can't get information from the ground floor.
Yeah. Hey, Steve, so I want to echo his sentiment. I think that so many people have been forgotten, and our attention drifts away from real important issues. If any one of us had a family member that was affected by this, we'd be screaming from the mountaintop. The fact that the institutions, like the institution that I belong to, kind of ignore this. I brought this up in a meeting to our executive board and was told that I couldn't come here as a member of the general executive board, so I'm coming here as a human being who cares about people, who put myself in the shoes of a mother that might be losing a child, or a father who's the only working person that bring an income into a house, or a mother that's the only working person. All of a sudden, their life is completely turned upside down, and everybody's left. I mean, Biden comes out here and makes an appearance. But every single day they get up, they're living in this situation. They can't sell their homes. If they were to sell their homes, where are they going to go? What is your house worth? How does that translate to another place? How do you find another job? These people just need some help. And we need to, the reason I'm here is to help them scream from the mountaintop. I hope this catches fire and people understand how critical this is to the well-being of other of our fellow Americans. This is tragic.
And it's like the Wild Wild West because, I mean, there's still more train derailments.
Yeah.
Even after this thing, and they're still talking about legislation, and also this mass casualty incident site under the Stafford Act, they could pass it so they could get health care for their ailments and also get their homes purchased. It happened at Love Canal, but it seems like it's pulling teeth, not only just to get the government to do it, but get our unions to say, stand up for these people.
Yeah, and where's the, you know, there's a lot of talk about that rail bill. Where is it at now? It's hung up in Congress. I mean, it's probably, even though it has majority support, it's probably not going to get a vote in the House. It probably won't be able to overcome a filibuster in the Senate. So, you know, it's interesting that this is about health care. We're here demanding health care for the people of East Palestine, the people affected by this derailment, because health care triggered our strike. The Post-Gazette company stripped the health care away from members of four of our five unions. They went out on strike. We went out on strike 2 weeks later. It's all about health care. Health care could resolve our strike. I was looking last night, I was doing a little bit of research. I found that in this country, 650,000 people each year go bankrupt because of their medical bills. That's more people than who live in the city of Detroit. We have the richest country in the world. We have like almost 800 billionaires in this country, and we have more people than who live in Detroit that are filing for bankruptcy because they cannot pay their medical bills. That to me is that's crazy. That's a crazy way to run a country, and it's unsustainable.
I couldn't agree more. Corporate America is destroying America. They own the political system, they own the politicians, and people are doing without. People used to inherit things like their homes from their parents and that. Nowadays, people get sick and they lose everything they own before they become a ward of the state. There has to be a better way to administer health care than we're doing right now. People's well-being shouldn't be tied to corporate profits.
And the AFL-CIO, the Teamsters, these national unions, you think they should make a focus here as an example of the fact that if people can't get health care in East Palestine after what happened, this catastrophe caused by Norfolk Southern, what does it mean for the rest of workers who are losing their jobs or on strike or they can't afford health care? Their life is destroyed. That's really a nightmare what people are going through.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's a good point. And one of the things that makes me proud about this effort here is that it is union people coming together with working people, working class people. So we're not here asking for higher wages for ourselves. We're not asking for better benefits for ourselves. We're looking at a working class community that's struggling because they don't have health care, because they were damaged by a billion-dollar company that dumped a toxic load in their backyards. That's why we're here. And that is something that can affect any community in the United States. It doesn't matter whether you're a union member or a non-union member. That's what it's all about. And I think for labor going forward, that seems to me to be the path to see where we come together. We can come together on these issues. It doesn't matter what, you know, the one day of the year when you walk into a voting booth and flip a switch, we can disagree on that, right? Where's that going to get us? In 5 years, we're still going to have the same discussion about health care. It's like, but we can change that. There's power in us coming together across union lines and include people who are not union, because we have the same interests and we can benefit from winning the same battles.
So I'm going to reinforce Steve's statement again. We have a commonality as human beings. I coached my kids basketball, football, baseball. Many of the kids that I coached worked for competitors of the company I worked for, and they were non-union. We all still love and care about one another. Some of us were union, some of us weren't. This is bigger than whether you're in a union or not. This is about us as Americans, and we've got to solve this problem. This is getting away from us, and the only way we're going to solve this problem is from the grassroots. All the institutions are pushing back against us because of the money and the influence. It's got to come from the grassroots.
So that should be a lesson of other workers around the country who face similar things, uniting together around issues like healthcare.
Yeah, yeah, and uniting around them. I mean, because we are going to disagree on some things. We're going to disagree on politics. That's kind of a given. Who gives a crap? You know, in the end, we can disagree about politics, but we can't get anything done that way. We can get something done if we come together around the issues that are important to us and recognize the human. And you know, John makes a great point. Recognize the humanity in each other, and resist the temptation to have arguments and to disagree. There are organizations in this world that thrive when we fight. And we don't have to do that. We don't have to give in to that. We can come together and agree on these things. It feels a lot better to me to do that and to think, okay, we have a goal that we can all agree on and we can all go in the same direction here.
And getting the CWA, our union nationally, to call on Biden to do this, getting the Teamsters, getting the AFL-CIO, Liz Shuler, that would be a step forward if they could all come together and say, let's get health care for the people of East Palestine. This group of workers and families who are suffering, who are getting cancer, getting heart problems. I mean, just the basic human right, get health care for these people.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, as a longtime organizer, I think about folks that, you know, whatever your faith is, you know, Jesus was a great organizer, right? What would Jesus do? You know, that used to be an old lifelong question. Would Jesus approve of people not having health care and literally dying? Isn't there a community responsibility here? So it's on us to stand up, fight, and be heard.
Those were the voices of two workers who were attending a conference in East Palestine, Ohio. They were Pittsburgh Union Progress reporter Steve Mellon and John Palmer. International Vice President of the Teamsters Union, speaking with Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
Well, the workers know the problem and listen to them till they run the show. To sound the alarm for everybody that's been harmed and to stand up here. This is where we start in our hearts. The people of East Palestine.
That was Mike Stout performing his new song, Stand Up for East Palestine. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Aku Holt. Next, retired U.S. Marine Corps Captain and Eisenhower Media Network Executive Director Matthew Ho addressed the U.N. Security Council during its briefing on Ukraine on March 24, 2024.
Madam President, thank you. As a way of introduction, I'm a U.S. Marine Corps combat veteran of the Iraq War. In 2009, I was a political officer with the U.S. State Department in Afghanistan. I resigned my position over the escalation of that war. I have been a direct participant in the violence of war. I know its moral wickedness. I know its intellectual dishonesty. And that's why I sit here today with a white poppy on my lapel to remember and to represent all the victims of war. It's my hope that being here today, I could represent those who do not very often have a voice at this table. I was last in this building as a Cub Scout when I was 10 years old. That was 1983, the same year as the now well-documented near-nuclear war between the United States and the Soviet Union. If not for the actions of one man that September, I might not have had the opportunity to grow up and live my life. None of you would have either. May God bless the memory of Stanislav Petrov. 8 years later, in 1991, the same year I graduated high school, the Soviet flag came down at the Kremlin, and the Cold War ended. Collectively, we have been given the potential of a world no longer divided into two opposed nuclear armed camps. The reality of that potential proved short-lived, and now here we sit, no safer, and arguably at a greater risk of nuclear war than in 1983. Looking back, that lost potential for a world that could have been elicits a bitterness, part anger and part despondency, that casts a grave and sorrowful shadow over this institution. In the past 30 years, the number of nuclear-armed nations has grown. Arms treaties have been broken, including unilaterally and without merit by my own country. Modernization of nuclear forces by all parties has greatly increased the destructive capability of missile and bomber fleets. So that even though the numbers and yields of nuclear weapons have diminished, improved accuracy has increased the destructive power of those fleets. There are warheads designated as usable nuclear weapons. Disturbingly, we have generals, diplomats, and politicians who believe such things exist. The dissolution of arms control talks following the abrogation of the treaties leaves us with nuclear armed powers that not only do not have the mechanisms to restart talks, but also do not have the means to talk even during a crisis. That speaks nothing of the lack of political will or the immense mistrust between the nuclear powers. I have been speaking of the nuclear weapons at the top rung of the escalation ladder. Today, it is the weapons being used in Ukraine that are leading us to that top rung, which is an apocalyptic point of no return. The U.S. and NATO strategy for the war in Ukraine has been two-pronged, economic and military. Neither have worked and neither will work. As the strategy has failed, it has not been revisited, replaced, or remanded, but reinforced. Thus, we have seen a steady wave of escalation for 2 years. The U.S. and its allies never considered diplomacy a needed third prong, which should have been the primary and dominant effort. Diplomacy was openly disparaged and repudiated. This was appalling diplomatic malpractice. And now, as a consequence, we sit here today as the killing, the destruction, and the suffering enter their 26th month. The reality in warfare is that whatever new technology or tactic you introduce, your enemy will counter it, and more often than not, does so in an escalatory manner, to which you respond in kind. It is circular by nature, but also linear, hence the infamous escalation ladder. You escalate or you de-escalate. There is no neutral or parallel option. Ukraine is no exception to this. Attack the Kerch Bridge or blow up the Nord Stream pipeline, and Russia attacks Ukrainian energy infrastructure and port facilities. Send HIMARS rockets and Storm Shadow missiles to Ukraine, and Russia introduces glide bombs and hypersonic weapons. On Monday, President Putin announced the Russian goal of buffer zones in Ukraine, presumably territory to the west of the annexed oblast that will be taken as a response to the extended range munitions and F-16 fighters to be provided to Ukraine. In recent weeks, multiple NATO's heads of state and their generals, most prominently the French, have openly called for the deployment of NATO combat units to Ukraine. The Russian response has been to remind us of their nuclear capabilities. This is an escalatory game for fools and madmen. We are lucky we have made it this far. The arguments for continuing this war reside in the domain of those whom the American political scientist C. Wright Mills labeled crackpot realists in the first decade of the Cold War. Yet those crackpot realists had the good sense not to engage in a war like Ukraine. And both sides had leaders like Jack Kennedy and Nikita Khrushchev, and Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev, men who had the courage and integrity to negotiate. I do not condone or support Russia's invasion. Although provoked, it is a preemptive war that violates international law and is a strategic error. However, it must be noted that Russia attempted negotiations in 2021, 2022, and 2023, efforts that may have prevented, concluded, or frozen this war if those diplomatic offers had been responded to in kind. This war is a brutal and unwinnable meat grinder, The toll is shocking and disgusting. It is a moral horror. Hundreds of thousands of casualties and 10 million refugees. Incalculable environmental and infrastructure damage. Eastern Ukraine is a land depopulated, devastated, and destroyed. Its fields and towns are saturated with mines and unexploded ordnance, and the toxic residue of modern war poisons its air, land, and water. Generations of unborn Ukrainians will pay for this war, either in land made uninhabitable or through mothers who give birth to dead, deformed, and disabled babies. Ask the representatives here from Iraq, Cambodia, Laos, Vietnam, and other nations if you believe war ever comes to an end. I believe the representative from Algeria can tell you about what landmines do to a people and a land. The escalatory trajectory of this war points to a risk greater than anyone should be willing to accept. This institution must do everything in its power to preclude any further escalation of this war, and everything possible to force a ceasefire and initiate a political process for a lasting peace. If a ban on the transfer of weapons and munitions into this war is what is needed to force a ceasefire negotiations, then so it must be. This Security Council must accept the responsibility of this moment and act to end this existential peril we face. Finally, I wish to make a plea to abolish the UN Security Council veto. Whatever justifications the veto may have had, specious and self-serving as they often were, the ongoing genocide in Gaza has forever nullified such arguments. Claims made at this table that to protect civilian lives, ceasefire resolutions must be vetoed, or as Orwellian as the assertions made in Washington, D.C. and Tel Aviv that genocide is self-defense. As the Palestinian people are being defiled and destroyed, for 5 months the U.S. has defied the world, providing diplomatic cover and unlimited military assistance to Israel as it carries out its unholy genocide in Palestine. In order for this institution to honor its founding commitments and principles, the permanent member veto must be abolished. Never again should a nation be able to protect occupation, oppression, apartheid, and genocide. Madam President, again, thank you.
That was retired U.S. Marine Corps Captain Matthew Ho addressing the UN Security Council. Music by Robert Glasper, So Beautiful. For Women's History Month, we honor Wilma Mankiller, who in 1983 became the principal chief of the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma and the first woman to serve as a chief of an indigenous nation in the United States. Under the Indian Relocation Act, Wilma's family relocated to San Francisco in 1957. She became deeply committed to the indigenous activism and joined the occupation of Alcatraz in 1969. She also worked with the Black Panther Party's food program for elders and children. Here's Wilma talking to a group of scientists and others at NASA in 1988.
There's been so much media attention paid to me because of the fact that I'm in an unusual role. And I think that the media attention's focus on me because most people have a lot of stereotypes about what a chief should look like. And most people's idea, I think, is that a chief should look like Charlie or should be someone with a lot of feathers or someone on a horse or something. And I certainly don't fit people's vision of what a chief should look like. Also, people aren't sure quite sure what to call me. I've had people tell me that who spend their time worrying about such things that principal chief is a male term, and that they think that I should call myself chiefette or chiefdess. And one woman tried for a long time to convince me that historically I should be called chieftainess. I thought that was interesting. And then this one old fellow thought that he hit on the right title. He said he thought that my name should be Mischief. Most people wonder what a modern chief does. In the old days, there were romantic notions about about the role of a chief. And I think there are a lot of misconceptions about what a modern chief does. My job is really like being a CEO. I spend my time doing many of the same things that chief executive officers of medium-sized corporations do, trying to keep revenue coming in. I spend a lot of time worrying about fiscal matters, about internal management kinds of things, about long-range planning, long-range development, trying to figure out how to continue to balance things, trying to listen to our people in eastern Oklahoma, which is a rural area. Most of the people are very poor, trying to listen to people and figure out what it is we need to be doing and moving toward finding solutions to our problems. The job is sort of like a war, like our old chief used to make decisions about war and peace, and certainly my job is like a war, but our wars today are wars against inadequate housing and poor health care and illiteracy and those kinds of things, so the war is very different. It's very important to understand a little bit about why some of the problems exist today in our communities. For most people outside of our communities, they look at all the social indicators of decline in our communities and they shake their head and they wonder why. And I think that you'll always wonder why if you don't put things in a historical perspective. Many of you, particularly those of you who work in very futuristic scientific fields, probably wonder why tribes exist at all today. The way in which the government deals with this today is on a government-to-government relationship, the federal government. That relationship was defined by our very first contact with the Europeans, with the newly emerging Americans. And the agreements we made with the United States government were defined by agreements and treaties. So when you hear people talk about treaty rights, they're talking about those agreements that tribes made with the newly emerging America. A lot of people will argue today that treaties are no longer valid, that they were written a long time ago, and that argument makes as little sense as arguing that the United States Constitution isn't valid because it was written quite some time ago. Treaties are treaties and agreements are agreements, and those treaties are still valid. Contrary to what you may have read and what limited amount of American history is available, or seen on movies or that sort of thing, what the wars were about with the American Indian tribes, what those wars were really about were about land and land retention. Basically, we were small groups of people, small tribes of people, trying to retain their historical land base. During the reservation era, which followed the war era, there was an attempt by the United States government to take all the tribes and isolate them from the rest of society. So when you hear people talking about reservations today, those reservations were created essentially to isolate Native people from the rest of society. And there were a couple of reasons for that. One reason, which is the most obvious reason, is that the historical land base of tribes was probably a piece of land or a piece of property that the United States government wanted to open up to settlement. And so they would physically remove people from their homeland and put them on a reservation. Another reason, and you can find a lot of discussion of this in historical documents, was that the Europeans didn't understand American Indians. And because they didn't understand them, they thought that they should be isolated and put away somewhere removed from the rest of society. One graphic example of the difference in thinking between the Europeans and the Native people was the concept of land ownership. You can look at historical documents and see where tribal leaders were trying to grasp the European concept of private ownership of land. And the Europeans were trying to grasp Native people's understanding that you could not own a river or a mountain or a lake or a piece of property, that belonged to everyone and everything. land issue, which was the overriding issue, the desire for the land of the tribal people, and then there was the other issue of cultural misunderstandings. In our tribe, we have had, since the beginning of time, our own constitution. Our constitution is placed on a wampum belt. To a European looking at our wampum belt, it looks like a beautiful beaded belt. Has no meaning to them at all. But to us, the placement of the beads and the color of the beads indicate very complex systems for ordering our society and complex value systems and beliefs and principles of democracy. And so there were those kinds of misunderstandings about people. Anyway, during the reservation era, every tribe has a history and a story of what happened to their tribe. It's important for all of us to try to do as much as we can to eliminate stereotypes. And so that we hear so often stereotypes that we're good with our hands but not particularly good with our heads, that we start to believe negative stereotypes ourselves. So I think it's very important to make sure that we try to eliminate as many of those stereotypes as possible by giving concrete, positive examples of Native people who are excelling. And speaking of stereotypes, I hope my being here today has helped to erase any stereotypes you might have about what a chief looks like.
Wilma Mankiller has been given many high honors and awards, including the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 1998. In her memoir, Mankiller, A Chief and Her People, she wrote, "I want to be remembered as the person who helped indigenous people restore faith in themselves." Wilma joined the ancestors in 2010. Thanks to Jacqueline Baptiste of KPFT for sharing this report.
Jagayu, gather together, we stand to honor with roses and cedar. All the colors of sunrise and sunset, a beloved woman who walked among us. Jagayu, Ani, Jalagi, ancestor dreaming, gives birth to children, mountains turn to pools of dust. Breathing becomes song when a beloved woman walks among us. Each praise song gives birth to the next. Each beloved leader makes a path for the rest. Keep the fire going as she passes by. A beloved woman walked among us. Stand up.
That was Mankiller Honor Song by Joy Harjo from Red Dreams, A Trail Beyond Tears. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective with contributions from Steve Zeltzer, Akul Holt, Jacqueline Baptiste, and Garrison, J.R. Bell-Ray, and Paulina Vasiliev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismracesanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at Pacifica CRD. I've been your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening.